90.3 on your FM dial.
And good evening, and welcome to the Thursday, April 21st edition of Dromo Text. Tonight on the show, we have someone special, an extraordinary poet, Michael S. Harper, who recently passed away in May of 2016. He was an English professor at Brown University, poet laureate of Rhode Island, and wrote a number of extraordinary works, including Dear John, Dear Coltrane, and Images of Kin, both of which were nominated for the National Book Award in the United States. This is a lecture that he presented at the University of California at Berkeley, one-hour lunch poem series. So without further ado, here's Michael S. Harper. Enjoy.
The following program contains adult language and themes and is intended for mature audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
I spent last night rereading the last part of his collected poems. I know the early poems very well, but in the way that we get busy and kind of keep up with each other by reading the new book, I have not read the late poems in the way that I've read the early poems. I read it last night with so much admiration for the way his work has continued to evolve and develop, and the difficult moral, rhetorical places he found himself in as a person who had to be a spokesman for a whole aspect of American life as well as a poet speaking for himself. Michael has been that figure also as an editor and a critic for the most important revisionary books about the aesthetics of African American poetry that have been published in the last 50 years are Michael's own editing. First of them is the collected poems of Sterling Brown, in exactly the way that Alice Walker found and revived Zora Neale Hurston and made her alive for a new generation of writers. Michael revived Sterling Brown's great book, one of the great books of 20th century poetry, Southern Road, which had basically disappeared. Michael brought it back into the canon of American poetry, that amazing book. Following that, he edited a book called A Chant of Saints, which is the most original anthology that looks over the whole history of the aesthetics of African American art in the late 19th and the 20th century. At a time when the last anthology of African American poetry, The Black Poets, edited by Dudley Randall, was, from my point of view, probably we're of the same generation, so probably for the same reason, stuck in a certain political aesthetic that didn't represent the whole range of what had happened or could happen in African American poetry, Michael edited two books. First of all, the amazing Every Shut Eye Ain't Asleep, which he did with a young, wonderful young poet named Anthony Walton, an anthology of African American poetry since 1945, which relooks at the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks and of Robert Hayden, and starts there and reads through the African American poetry with a very fresh and original eye. It's a wonderful book to read. And then the more comprehensive and more recent, published in 2000, vintage book of African American poetry. If you read his poems, you can see both the inner and outer struggle of this amazing man to find a language for his experience in America. And if you turn to these other books, you will get an education in American poetry like you won't find anywhere else. We're very lucky to have him here today. Please welcome Michael Harper.
Nice to be back home. Very interesting how So much of the great poetry of America is about the neighborhood. And my first neighborhood was Brooklyn, New York, and I was born in the same house my mother was born in and delivered by the same man. So when I think about my early years, everything revolves around Brooklyn, which was the first suburb in America. It was an individual, independent kind of appendage to New York City. And I grew up in New York City. I grew up on the subways of New York City during World War II. My mother taught me to read and write, and the first book I remember was The Arabian Nights. And I used to call my sister Scheherazade. My sister is 5 years younger than me and the bully of the family. Commanded me to come to California to see our father. And when are you going to come and see the people that really matter? And I said, soon. So I used this as a kind of lever to go down there and see her and my father and all of the other relatives who have transplanted themselves to Los Angeles County, which is not the best place to be, by the way. We used to make jokes about it being a series of concentric circles with no center, and that is still the case. But now that we have a new governor, he's going to make it known. I promised myself I wouldn't reminisce, I would just read to you. So I brought some work, and I'm not going to comment, as I often do, about poems, because there's not enough time. I remember, just like it was yesterday, being invited by Jim Chaville to come to Brown University. And the first thing he said to me was, you know, one of our major expectations was to steal you from the Bay Area. And we have managed to do that. So I looked at him, and then he introduced me to his wife, who's a friend of mine. And he said, if I can't do it, she can. You know, she'll sell the place to you. So I came back after I'd had my little 2-3 days in the middle of winter. And I went to one of my mentors, who is deceased, but is still a lioness of this community. Her name was Josephine Miles. And I said to her, Brown University wants me to come. She says, Michael, don't you know we're trying to hire you here? I said, how long is it going to take you? I said, because I am going. So I went. And with that, I'm going to read a few poems. I've been very lucky in many ways. So many of my opportunities came out of accidents. And Giovanni, who's sitting out there editing a magazine, she's been in a workshop that I conducted for Kaveh Khanum, A Dog's Life for Afro-American Poets. And I said to myself, if I ever got myself in a situation where I would tell them the truth about how hard it is, I'll do it. And she was one of the people in there. Now she's editing a magazine and wrote me online. And I gave her a couple of poems on the blues and blah, blah, blah. And there she is sitting in the audience. So this is progress from life for me in the 1950s. Now, we have a secretary in the English department who was a jazz lover, and she writes me little emails and says, I just heard you read on such and such and such and such a channel. And I think to myself, when am I ever going to get away from this, you know? But then her grandma died, and a notice went out. So I wrote a little email, and I don't know very much about electronic anything. So if you know anything about email, you know that if you print email out, there sometimes is a very thin line that goes across it. And what that tells you is that was what was transmitted and the rest of it wasn't. But I printed out because I can barely read that stuff off the screen or whatever. So I'm just going to read it to you. And it's called Listening Images. And the poems come from Lawson Inada, who's a Japanese American who went here as a freshman to UC Berkeley and failed out. Went back home to Fresno State and then went to Iowa. I met him in Iowa. He's a wonderful guy, and exactly my age. So I decided I would send this by email to this woman And the only thing they came across was the first couplet, which is about Lester Young. But I'm going to read all of them because I printed out and I went by the office and I said, listen, I'm going to be away for a while. And I hear, and she says, this, none of this transmitted. She's all angry. So I said, well, what are you telling me for? You know, she says, well, I wanted all of these things, you know, whining through her grief. I knew exactly what was wrong. So this is called Listening Images, and her name is Marianne Costa. And I don't know her very well, and it's nice to write poems about people you don't know very well, you know. So she's in the right spot. So it's called, the subject is Recent Losses from Listening Images by Lawson F. Annotta. Lawson F. Annotta wrote the first commercially published book of poetry by a sensei in this country. Second generation Japanese American, spent his childhood in the camps. So here's the poem. Lester Young. Yes, clouds do have the smoothest sound. Billie Holiday. Hold a microphone close to the moon. Charlie Parker. Rapids to baptism in one blue river. Ben Webster. Such fragile moss in a massive tree. Ben Webster. We used to call him the Hawk. Was a guy who seconded on stride piano. He's a great stride piano player. He says any horn man who tells you he can't play piano is lying to you. Miles Davis, three valves, tubing, how many feelings? Art Tatum, innumerable dew, a splendid web. John Coltrane, sunrise golden at the throat. And I added mine, which I would suggest that you lobby with the Addison people, because it's a small poem, it's only three lines, and I wrote it for Miles Davis. MSH are my initials. That's how I signed my correspondence, MSH. A friend told me he'd risen above jazz. I leave him there. Now this is for the woman who gave me my reputation. Her name is Gwendolyn Brooks. She wrote magnificent poems. And it's a strange thing about growing up in the 50s and 60s. Literacy was important for my generation. And of course I knew who Gwendolyn Brooks was. And when I went to Iowa as a graduate student, Paul Engle would say to me, you know, Gwendolyn Brooks and Margaret Walker were two winners that I selected for such and such a prize. And I realized by instinct that Paul Engle was a tremendous horse trader. And I was one of the horses. You know, I had to be careful. He'd call me on the phone and he would say, we're having some West Coast people in town. We'd like you to come over for cocktails. Denise Levertov. Or, we're bringing someone who's obscure to you, you've never heard of. W.H. Auden. I said, oh, really? You know, which brings me to my point, Margot. My daughter, who's 31 and has written a novel, several books of poems, and I don't know what else. She won't let me read anything. Came over to my house the other day and gave me a copy of The Prairie Schooner. She has three poems in there. And she said, thanks for forwarding that message that you got from so-and-so. And I said, yeah, he read the poems online. He told me all about it. I didn't even know these poems were published. She'd written them years ago. So she gave me a copy. And then she gave me some photographs of my granddaughter, whose name, which she stole from my middle son, is Auden, A-U-D-E-N, Alexis Harper. Now, it's not a bad thing to name any child Auden. And I'll tell you an Auden story in a minute. But this is for Gwendolyn Brooks. She once gave a talk, and she described her own poems in this way, and that's the epigraph to the poem. And the poem is called The Poet's Voice. Love, light, loss, liberty, lunacy, and laceration. You know. So, The Poet's Voice. Too much made of birth in Topeka. Too little made of Chicago defender. Contributor at 16. the odd job solo moments of community gloss in each kitchenette clipping, microscopic tintypes of losses and gains, without the slightest naivete of the street, backyard, parlor grid. Her masterpiece of the singing tree, we real cool in 1959, anticipates the rest of the century. After Fisk in 1967, known by detractors and sycophants alike as Mother Africa, but she remains a citizen in daily interiors of unassailable synapse, contralto arpeggios released in bemused attributes of light at the end of her Lincoln West Tunnel, wordsmith of the real thing, exhortingly brave in every territory for those unsung in service evermore. Now the last line is a borrowing, theft of The Merchant of Venice, in love and service evermore. And she was a magnificent service to her people. The next is a former student of mine. She's dead now. She died in 1999. Her name is Shirley Williams, Shirley Ann Williams. She wrote her MA thesis with me called Give Birth to Brightness. And she left Brown University because she couldn't stand the cold. She was born in Bakersfield and grew up in the fields of San Joaquin Valley picking cotton and various other things. One of the smartest people I know. So I chastised her one day. She'd written an essay and various other things. And I said, look, I said, because you have been born and raised in the fields, doesn't mean you're ignorant. I said, one of your teachers, Sterling Brown, used to recite to me over and over two couplets, which I know you know. I don't know why my mother wants to stay here for, this old world ain't been no friend to her. Or, I've been down so long that down don't worry me. So I said, why don't you stop acting like you don't have any brains? You know, you do have brains. One of the idioms that you speak in is this particular idiom, but you speak in other ones too. So here's the poem. Shirley Ann Williams, 1944-1999. Worshipped in the fields, sometimes in darkness, heat at high noon, killing fields, but after water, fluorescent crops, braceros picked. You sent me a tape, short and full, of healing music. I copied it for my mother. Put you in every book I could read or write. Remember your commentaries at public tables, in and out of the university. Outtakes are best, your heart a map. Ancestors weeping. So I was sitting in a little outpost in Saratoga Springs. It was in August. And all of a sudden, I had brought some tunes. All of a sudden, I realized this was the 40th anniversary of Kind of Blue, Miles Davis put together. So I said, you can't let this day go by without writing something about him. So this is called Release, Kind of Blue. And the date, 8/17/99, is the day that it was released. Release, Kind of Blue. Miles, being ahead, came in early with the sketches. He did not mention Japanese visual art, though Bill Evans did, his liner notes stretching each brushstroke as metaphor for playing together. Because you cannot go back, resonance builds, new material at a recording session. Only once in a lifetime. For these players, five settings and a figure who asked of us to do this perfectly, as if to play live, alone, in a group. Miles asked, we answered. I used to hear these comments about Miles hating white people. And I listened to his discography, and all these white people keep showing up, you know. Bill Evans, all kinds of folks that, you know, Miles played with. Bill Evans was the guy who put Kind of Blue together. Without him, there would have been no Kind of Blue. So it's important that you understand ensemble and solo work and how they unify themselves. You key off of other people. And I had seen Bill Evans play in a nightclub in Sausalito called a Spinnaker when I was a boy. And he was very strung out, drooling on his fingers and all that. And I might or might not read that poem, but I love him. This poem is the lesson that I have to teach my young people, including my kids, who say to me, "Dad, I didn't know you knew anything about Motown." I kind of look at them, you know, like, what's wrong with them? You know, hanging out with people, going to the movies, listening to these soundtracks, and that's their first exposure with Motown. Well, I grew up in Detroit when I was going to graduate school, chasing women, and God knows what else. So you don't tell them anything, you just let it go, you know. But then they steal my records, you know. This is called Ray Brown, great bassist from Pittsburgh, If You Don't Force It. And when I wrote it, he was alive. He's dead, died recently. If You Don't Force It. He's talking about interpolations, riffs that come in the midst of action, responding to the line, accommodating the blues, and not neglecting the melody, refusing to smother beauty with too many chords. To show off is to bungle the melody with chordal blocks, not building anything to your baby, hiding the melody like only the young can do. Lester Young would watch the dancers moving into his vernaculars with rhythms augmenting the melody. Herschel would set the pace. Prez would follow. Count would cop time, as though you could improve on stride piano. Ben Webster could do stride. When you get possessed with wild chords, tie your left hand behind your back. Then play the melody with one finger on your right hand. Put the melody on your heart. Now, I don't want to throw stones, but I'm going to throw some today. I was a student of Philip Roth when I was at Iowa, and he accused me of writing a pornographic novella. He also gave me 9 units of C. His intention was to drive me out of the writing program. And I had been a student of, among other people, Christopher Isherwood, and had read a lot of things. I didn't talk a lot, but I had knew a few things about the fable, and I'd read some Golding, and I'd read this and read that. My first paper in his seminar was on The Lord of the Flies. So I gave this paper and turned it in, about 20 pages. Never gave it back to me. You know, weeks went by. So finally I asked him about it, and he gave me a B-, no comment. So I made a conference with him in one of those, what do they call them, barracks on the Iowa River. And it was a very short conference because he assumed that I had read No Joyce, that I didn't know various other people, that I'd read on my own. And I said to Philip Roth, I said, "Mr. Roth, I'd like to tell you a story which is a metaphor for my education. Mr. Isherwood, who taught a course between the wars, his father died in World War I, never mentioned his father, started with the books that he felt we needed to understand modern life from the English point of view. So he began with I'm trying to think about what the order was, because the order is not really the order. But I was working graveyard, and I was coming to class, and class met on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And one day, a guy comes in with bedroom slippers on and an unbelievable face. Looked like a road map with all the various kinds of tributaries on it. And he called me. I sat in a way back. He called me, he said, "Mr. Harper," he says, "do you have a question for our distinguished guest?" So I looked down. I should have been in bed, you know, haven't worked since till 7:30. This was 9:30. So I said to him, "Would you ask our distinguished guest if he might recite to us September 1, 1939? And Isherwood grinned. And Auden recited without text for 40 minutes. So the girl who was sitting next to me, who I'd never spoken to before, said to me, "You must be the smartest person in class," which I was. But she didn't know that. And then she said, this will tell you about the times when people were called Negroes. She would say things, the one thing she could say that she knew, she'd say, "I guess you want to be the new Langston Hughes." Langston Hughes had just recently died, 67. Which, from her point of view, was a compliment. You know, so I took it as a compliment. So this is for Philip Roth, and I haven't sent it to him. I haven't even published it, and I probably won't. But it's called Philip Roth, and it'll be in my papers. And in your consciousness. "Your characters have done dark deeds and gotten away with most of them. The Gauguin boy at the library has not gotten away, and he is not Willie Mays, which is the center field you yourself cannot patrol. A zany literate frenzy at the Harvard Yard, your own long-range bibliography. For all good readers know how much biography is auto, how much self, how much persona. So change the gender to rhetorical truth and put up ante to the feminist union. Forgive your relatives and seminarians at Shul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Learn to fly in the Haifa Air Force, practicing your Persian, whose framed tail is all daylight where eunuchs parade as peaks keepsakes to the harem. 1001 nights, the beloved's domain, where storyline is vespers, before the phone line long divisions of Judah awakened at the oasis. And you could let me down your string, slight capillary to the librarian shelf, and let that boy as character have the books of his dreams, whose fare he could not conjure, except in his fleece-lined black imagination, the surface of which is craft at depiction, metaphor, a true image to live by." Now, I'm thinking about the human stain and the character who his main character was based on, who was a member of my parents' family. He was from New Orleans. His people were from New Orleans. And he was light enough to pass because in order to get ahead during that period, if you were able to pass, you did. You know, people left New York and went all over the country to Phoenix, Arizona, where they had no tradition of identifying people who were very light-complected, you know. And they had somebody on CNN or somebody like that, I think it was Gordon Williams, who went to Williams College and whose father was a classmate of Sterling Brown, very light-complected, commenting about there really are light-complected black people, in this case Negroes, who pass for white. It was a whole generation of people. We call those people, some of them, the talented tenth. And not all of them were light either. Some of them were dark. As my mother used to say, "We are surrounded by the talented tenth. The ones who are passing for white are worthless, and the ones who are dark got all the money and all the education. Which one will you follow?" she says. That's my mama. She was tough, boy. And I would come to home with these crazy notions I picked up in the street, and she'd just look at me with disgust, you know. She wouldn't even say anything. She just look at me. "Where did you get this preposterous idea? I taught you better than that." And then she'd say, for the thousandth time, "All you have is your good name." She'd say that thousands of times. When I was about 45, I figured out what she meant. You know, I didn't know a damn thing about what she meant then. She would say things like, "Don't sleep with women you can't take care of." I was about 5. "What are you gonna do with that? You know, don't sleep with women you can't take care of." I'm thinking, what? You know. Then when I was about 6, she put my sister, who's 5 years younger than me, in my arms and says, "Your grandmother's sick, I gotta take care of her. You gotta help me." So she gave me my sister. So my sister, when she's mad with me, says, "I had 3 parents, my mother, my father, and my oldest brother." And she means every word of it. She's mean. She's also tough. But she's my baby sister, you know, and I did take care of her because I loved her. So when I was about 7, I thought I was going to get some relief. So when I was about 7, my father walked up to me one day and he said, "Your mother does know floors." That's all he said. My father said one thing, one time. "Your mother does know floors." That meant they were mine, you know. "Don't let me see a mop in your mother's hand ever again." But I love my mother, so it ain't a big deal, you know. Okay. Then we moved to California. I was 13. I just graduated from 8th grade. Gotten into all the best schools. And they were trying to save us from gang fighting. So they moved to L.A., of all places. You know, so parents, I understood their efforts. They were trying to protect us, to keep us out of trouble. So when I was in my late 30s, maybe older than that, and Allen Ginsberg was teaching a course on living writers at Brooklyn College, where my parents had gone to school. So he invited me and my mentor, Gwendolyn Brooks, to read together in a live audience. So we show up. I read first, and she reads later. She was doing a program in New York, and I was quite happy to be on the same program with her. And then there was a question and answer period, and the guy raised his hand and said, "I understand you're from Brooklyn." I said, "Yeah." He says, "You mentioned gang fighting." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Who recruited you?" I said, "The Nits and the Jolly Stompers." He says, "I'm a retired lieutenant from the Jolly Stompers." This guy's old as me, you know. And then after he came up and he bought all my books and asked me to sign them, and this and that and the other, and asked me, he says, "Now," he says, "you made a mistake leaving this country," as if I had a choice, you know. He says, "If you'd have stayed here, you'd have been running the city by now." I thought to myself, yeah, right. My boy, my oldest boy, who's 37, went on a semester abroad. And he's a very sweet person, what we used to call tender-hearted, but you can't tell him a thing. So my mother said to him, "You know he's a fire horse." I said, "What?" You know, my mother read astrology and all kinds of black magic. We used to call her the witch doctor. She'd come up with these designations about people's attributes. So I didn't, I filed it. So then he went abroad, and he was about, he must have been 19 or 20 years old. And about 5 days before he was supposed to take off, he says, "I got this identity card." He says, "Everybody in the class has got one, and this is going to get me in the country." I looked at him. I said, "Oh, yeah?" I said, "Have you ever heard of passport?" So he looked at me. He says, "The last time you went to London, you were on your mother's passport with your brother and sister. You don't have a passport. And if you don't get one, you're not going to be able to get through Heathrow." So he looked at me in desperation. I said, "The people in passport office in Boston, they're used to fools like you. Call them up on the phone, call California, get a copy of your birth certificate." He was born in San Francisco, and have that FedExed, blah, 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 blah. He says, "Dad, it's only 4 days." I said, "But like I said before, they'll manage, you know." So the day before he left, he got his passport in the mail. So, of course, I've been hard on this kid, you know. And he went over on Pan Am, and he was scheduled to come back on the day of the Pan Am Flight 103. He was supposed to be on that flight. So that's what the poem's about. How much to Flight 103, Pan American? I watch my own son walk off the rib and skin of the plane on the day of the threat and not go down in smithereens over Scotland. Malt whiskey rolled oats on the battlefields of the Covenant, where armies strode in their coat of arms. We will clean up debris, sifting for evidence, a few money orders, traveler's checks, changed hands in the forest and the fields. And these children who found the tender children who placed the bombs in the kits of the cockpit or lavatory. It is a cabin fever we will live in forever. Darkness, patches of phosphorescent light, darkness in the common field of battle station, cemeteries a glitter. So every time we have a replay of those parents and relatives visiting the fields and whatever, I think about them. That could have been my boy, you know. And we should never forget that we're bound to one another in all kinds of ways, much of them we can't even possibly know, you know. And we think that we're just independent people, and then you find out that your best friend, for example, on that plane at 800 that went down in the bay off of JFK, Wayne Shorter lost his wife on that plane. 70 years old. Still playing beautifully. So I said to myself, he's got to have some enormous spiritual development to be able to cope with this. And sure enough, he's a Buddhist, you know. The Buddhists I know, they're prepared because they understand we're only here for a little time. And they don't spend a lot of time making enemies. If you listen to Wayne Shorter's music, you can just hear it, you know. So I love the fact that the musicians who have always been my teachers, even the gruff ones, you know, the monks, the Thelonious monks, because I think they're seers. And I'm going to read you a poem that I wrote for Philip Levine on his 75th birthday. I don't know whether Philip Levine and I are talking anymore because, you know, poets fall in and out of pattern with one another. And I hadn't been in touch with him for years and years. And a woman sent me an email and said, we're having a celebration for his 75th birthday. And I said, 75th birthday? He's born in January. This was like April. So I said to her, you know, he's born in January, but if you just want to celebrate him, okay. And then she said, if you want to say something, say something. So now I began to think about, did I owe him anything? Well, I owed him plenty. Philip Levine had done a lot of things for me. So this is what the poem's about. And it's called Couch. C-O-U-C-H. When I lived in San Francisco, I had no money. I didn't even have a checking account. And I got paid once a month. And we would go out to these auctions, and you had to buy things in lot. If you wanted one particular item, you had to buy all of it, you know. So we would go down there and we'd spend, you know, a little trifling, little money for this and that. And I put you could put an absentee bid on certain things. So I put an absentee bid on this particular couch. And forgot about it, you know, I didn't think. So here's the poem, Couch. I bought you in an absentee bid in my favorite city, San Francisco, while I drove the smaller arteries of the valley to Fresno. To give my first paid reading, went early to prepare to end badly. I had gone to the Modesto Relays as a boy when Willie White beat Bobby Morrow at the Compton Relays. The Valley boys out of the fields were faster than the banked indoor invitationals back east. And I had seen the Negro Leagues from the bleachers where Jack Roosevelt Robinson baptized the bums. My father was a Giant fan, and so was I, reporting the ball scores each morning to my father's schedule after graveyard shift. And now I would be reading my paltry poems at evening in Fresno. I read badly and too fast, and hung over. But when I returned to the fog belt of Miramar, I had a check for $75 with no expenses. I could tally, and the couch cost $74, 8 feet long on the four-door roof. So when I sit down now in a new century on the lower level of a converted jewelry factory, look out at the freeway traffic and off ramps, write the same bad chasseurs in the weak pulse to the arteries of Providence. Think of the granary, the single malt I cannot afford. Recover this couch, which was redone by a man dying of cancer in Twin Cities, carted to another home I could not sustain or build any better than an absentee bid across the continent of birth in the afterglow of Roger Williams before slavery, while slavery supported all trade in the New World. So when you look up at the chestnut beams up to the roof, think of the new tubing from air conditioning in summer, the pocked brick arsenal against the wintry winds. Remember this couch as weapon, about to be couched in a field of Social Security gone empty in war. To see the couch as battlefield, cemetery, garden truck, and no resting place, but an extra bed in middle passage. My daughter, who's maybe a grandpa, came over my house one day, and she's always coming over for money. So which I gladly write. I write a check, whatever she wants. Sometimes I send her one of just in the mail. So she came over and she gave me a story. I said, she says, you know, you always like to be accounted to, Dad. You know. Oh, her birthday is April 14th. And every April 14th, I send her something. And sometimes I don't see her, you know. You know, you got to get over the business of seeing your children just because you love them and all that. You know, I got three and they're all everywhere else. They would prefer to be in San Francisco or Madrid or Paris, as my daughter said to me one day. She called me on her 25th birthday, or near her 25th birthday, in Southern California. And she said, don't you think your only daughter should spend her 25th birthday in Paris? I said, done. Call my travel agent. I got a limit. I said, I'll buy the ticket, round trip, and $2,000 in cash. She was gone for 10 days, 2 weeks. So she groans. Okay, Dad. So I gave her my travel agent. So the travel agent calls me. She says, Rachel just called. Do you want this to happen? I said, absolutely. So she wrote the thing. My daughter went off. So that's the kind of daughter I got. Don't you think your only daughter should spend her 25th birthday in Paris? So this is called April in Paris, 4/14/98. Think a bird playing with strings while I read this. There is no guidebook for such botany as I drift on Bud Powell's glass enclosures. I would have taken you to Montmartre, a hike you would enjoy, no Heartbreak Hill in Hamilton. Richard Wright's Paris was not my grandparents, who were there in the crash of 29, and unhurried to return to the embers of Brooklyn. My aunt Alice Elizabeth was almost 12, about to take the L to an all-white school, though called Jack by her grandfather, AME Bishop Johnson, and not a gangster bishop when he spun at Vespers. Parker's tune with strings is no daisy chain for you, fresh ambrosia Latinate, sparkling in any tongue. The speech of Yeats, most Keatsian, black Irish, black English, as you were not at the source. I saw you born slightly past 1 a.m. in Boston, an iris frangible to touch and smell of a man possessed of a sacred music on strings, his only daughter, Rachel. Tony Williams, who's one of my favorite musicians and died a few years ago, had liver disease and was told he shouldn't play. Rest. And I had gone to school with Billy Higgins, who was a great drummer. I went to the same high school in Los Angeles that Eric Dolphy did, but not in the same year. So I knew about drummers, and you know, drummers come along very few and far between, and Tony Williams was one of those kind of magnificent drummers. And I was staying with a former student of mine who has a house right across the street from Galileo High School, where O.J. Simpson went as a student when he was going to school at all. He was a college dropout. And I was staying in his house, and all of a sudden, Tony Williams died, and he had a little book on his guest place. And he asked me to write something in it, so this is what I wrote. Tony Williams. Man before boys at bandstand, kid in the rough at seminar, beat unkind to his body, all animal skin your top hat, which we tip at your casket. Poets have a way of getting to you, and you don't think you really care about them, and then all of a sudden they die. So I was reading Alan Dugan's obituary, and Alan Dugan is not a friend of mine. I knew his wife, who's the daughter of Ben Shawn. And, you know, we used to see each other every now and then, but we weren't hanging out. We were not contemporaries. He's 80 years old. I'm just about 80. I feel 80. But I wrote this out because I said to myself, if you don't write this, you're not going to write this out, you know. You might even lose the obituary from the New York Times. So here it is. It's called Reading Alan Dugan's Obituary. Faculty Club Retirement Party. Ne'er-do-wells, victuals, cheap wine, like Bidwist in the ghetto. I'm way out of my element. The cards are shaky, bad paintings, When I come to interview, they had a whiskey cabinet, some premises, one key. I asked for single malt, got none. They lost the key. Went to combinations, sand in my malt. I cut my hair, mustache slipped. 18-year-old McCallum from a flask. R.V. Castle was drinking his bourbon. Truro time. One woman, who still wears purple, came into my office, dissertation time. I cut it in half. She wanted to fight. Brought lunch, Bloody Marys, thermos. Thought of you in Zocalo, 68. Student shot to Kip took out Ryan. Coltrane died that year. Before, glossed your paintings. Wordsmith, left and right, dead center pruned. Thought of Sonny, Nuke's natal day. Still alive, hearing the Brooklyn Bridge. Olivet Station, not even underground. Redstone Arsenal nearby. Droll dactyls. Drove into the Mass Pike traffic. Poems, P-O-E-M-S. Yale just asked for my papers. Give them to him. Meaning, the manuscripts, the memorabilia, the publications, the readings are not as important as the man. It's the maker that I'm pledging. It's not the poems, it's not the memorabilia. I'm reading in a library, and of course I love libraries, but I loved him more. I love the fact that he might come up with another book. Poems, he's real original with titles. Poems, one. Poems, two. Poems, three, and so on, you know. And here I am, writing these marvelous titles. I got great titles, you know. I'm gonna read two more, and then I'm gonna break, and then if anybody's got a request, please, please give it to me. One is a poem I wrote for my student now on a Fulbright in Russia. And she writes me complaining from St. Petersburg. And she and I did a book together. She made the book, created out of everything. She did all the etchings and printed it and so on and so forth. And she called it Sweet Homeland. And she came to me. She's a marvelous woman. She came to me and she said, is there anything you want to tell me that I haven't done that I need to do? I said, yeah. She says, what is it? I says, have you read War and Peace? She said, no. I said, you can't write that book without wearing War and Peace. So she finally listened to me. She took 2 days, 2 weeks out, and sat down and read it. Now she reads in English and in Russian. So she read a bilingual edition for 2 weeks. She came back and she said, I have wasted my life, haven't I? I said, not really. You're only 20 more, you know. I mean, you know, there are people that live to be 50 and 60 and never done that. You know, here you are, you're in your 20s. I said, you remember when you used to come to my office and you used to wear me out and I used to say, you're just like every other student I've ever taught. You're gonna waste your 20s. You know, you got all that pep. You read the wrong things, you know, trying to get along with your contemporaries, kissing ass, trying to, you know, trying to break out from your mother and all this. And you should be reading War and Peace. Or if you want to understand what happened just recently with this guy to kill all these prostitutes, what better lesson than to read about Raskolnikov, right? I mean, it's one of the greatest love stories that I know in modern literature in the 19th century. I mean, Dostoevsky could tell you something that other people can't tell you. So I wrote her this as an email. She kept hounding me. She's worried about going to graduate school. And I'm thinking to myself, graduate school? You in St. Petersburg? You know, 300th anniversary? You right down the street from where Pushkin used to sit in the park? And you rush into graduate school? To go where? You know. But when you're young, you just waste your time. You just waste your 20s. So this is what I wrote to her. It's called Notes on Translation While in Russia. It's in couplets. I have been reading Pasternak. I have been thinking about Fyodor's law. Only he could conceive of a murderer, convict, finding salvation in the love of a prostitute. The artist's law of intentional suffering. Now I am watching Laura and Yuri in installments in the black interior. So many souls shot down. The gulf between the gentry and the serf, your library. I have suggested Estonia on a day trip so you can absorb Siberia via President Miri's family line. I did this myself when Clinton and Yeltsin shuffled their decks of cards to be trumped in Latvia when a 13-year-old girl recited Frost's words and I answered with his Endive's Dive, a six-line ditty on gambling. I thought of Dostoevsky's Gambler when I was green at 20, fault lines. Now you must read the meters of Russian prosody as Brodsky would it command, and not drink the wine of the gulag when you already have Pushkin, his Parkway, your cell phone, and the Moscow triads of ballet, sonatinas of song lines, Siberian Tigre, the hunt into Finland, the Baltics, Germany munitions. The speech of the feminine, the body of Mozart, Rachmaninoff's hands, astride the snowbanks for one day only, of Fifth Avenue, Rockefeller Plaza, an etching of all this for the Dalkey Press one day. And yet the rose is best as a single poem in the midst of becoming. Become that opening as the snow falls in the strophes of this heartwork, Pushkin's Velocities. So here I am teaching her long distance, telling her don't waste your time. She's doing fine. She's just 24, you know. And that's what happens when you're 24. You just waste all that pep you got. And then you want the pep back when you're 60, but it ain't coming back, you know. Whereas, as Gene Toomer said, let the doing be the exhibition. Let the doing be the exercise, not the exhibition. There'll be a time when you won't have the gas in the tank. Let the doing be the exercise, not the exhibition. Or does anybody out there want to hear something? Yes. Ah, yes. I think I know that poem. Let me see if I can find it in this book. You know what they do? They print your books and they try and save two or three pages. So they change the order of the book. And they put what they think to be a standard table of contents in the back as a reference. And I never read this poem or read from this book because of it. You know, I'm kind of old-fashioned type. I like to know what pages the books are on, the poems are on. And if they don't give them to me, then I improvise. You know, I do something else. I wrote this poem in San Francisco, as a matter of fact. And my oldest boy was born there. And then we had two other children born there. And you know, San Francisco is a driving city, a lot of hills, this and that and the other, and a lot of vistas and a lot of memories, a lot of good music, a lot of good food, a lot of good people. It's the only city I really feel comfortable in the United States, not New York. So I was carrying this poem around. I knew I would sit down and write it. It's one of those kind of things you just know you're gonna do. And I put it off. I just put it off. I just wouldn't do it. And then finally I sat down one day and I just wrote it in 10 minutes, which I never do, you know. So I was trying to avoid what all of that had done. And I've been paid great compliments by people who have put my poems in the Norton Anthology, this and that and the other, and they say, this is reminiscent of Delmo Schwartz or Yeats's In Dreams Begin Responsibility, his volume of 1914 Responsibilities. None of that is true. But if you want to put me in that company, I love it. I got no problem with Yeats. Got no problem with Delmo Schwartz. Nightmare Begins Responsibility. I place these numb wrists to the pain, watching white uniforms whisk over him in the tube-kept prison. Fear what they will do in experiment. Watch my gloved stick-shifting gasoline hands bring Boxcar information, please. Infirmary tubes distrusting white, pink, mending paper-thin silken end hairs. Distrusting tubes shrunk in his trunk, skin cap shaven head. In thighs distrusting white hands picking baboon light. On his son who will not make his second night of this ward-strewn intensive air pocket. Where his father's asthmatic hymns of night train trained and gone, his mother can only know that he has flown up into essential calm unseen corridor, going boxcarred home, mama born sweet son child going downtown into research testing warehouse battery acid, mama son done gone. Me telling her another train tonight, no music, no breaststroke heartbeat in my infinite distrust of them and of my distrusting self. White doctor who breathed for him all night. Say it for two sons gone, say nightmare, say it loud, pain-breaking heart madness. Nightmare begins responsibility. Irony upon irony, long after I'd written the poem, I was teaching at Brown University, where I taught for many years, and I was going to this early bird swimming pool, and I was coming out of the place about 7 o'clock, and I ran into this guy who was dressed up in a white smock, and I knew him by his carriage and whatever, and I stopped him. I said, "Don't I know you?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "We met in San Francisco. I'm teaching at the Brown Medical School now." And he had been living in Hartford. He had moved from San Francisco and gone and lived in Hartford, and then he was moving again. And he was upgrading his various skills. And he stopped me at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I said to him, "Did anybody ever send you a copy of that book?" He said, "No." I said, "I'll send it to you in the campus mail." I said, "Because you're in a lot of my poems." So, anybody else? We got to get out of here. Elvin's Blues. All right. This one and the one for Bud, and then we'll end it, okay? Elvin's Blues. Sniffed, dilating my nostrils. The cocaine creeps up my leg, smacks into my groin. Naked with a bone for luck, I linger in stickiness, tickled in the joints. I will always be high. Tired of fresh air, the stone ground bread, the humid chant of music which has led me here, I read my song. They called me the Black Narcissus as I devoured the white hopes, crippled in their inarticulate madness. Crippled myself, drums, each like porcelain chamber pots upside down. I hear a faggot insult my white wife with a sexless grin, maggots under his eyelids. A candle of my fist print breaks the membrane of his nose. Now he stutters. Last Thursday, I lay with you, tincturing your womb with aimless strokes I could not feel. Swollen and hard the weekend, penitent, inane. I sank into your folds or salved your pastel, but could not come. Sexless as a pimp, dying in performance like a flare gone down. The tooth of your pier hones near the wharf. The ocean is breathing. Its cautious insomnia, driven here and there, with only itself to love. And this one for Bud, for Bud. Could it be, Bud, that in slow galvanized fingers, beauty seeped into bop like bird weed and diz clowned? Sugar waltzing back into dynamite, sweetest left hook you ever dug, baby. Could it violate violence, Bud, like Leadbelly's chain gang chuckle, the candied yam 12-string clutch of all blues? There's no rain anywhere soft enough for you. Thank you very much.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Drama Text. We've been listening to the work of the poems of Michael S. Harper, who passed away in 2016. He was the author of several extraordinary works, including Dear John, Dear Coltrane, which was nominated for the National Book Prize in the United States. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of The Spoken Word.
Soundwalk Symposium is a series of site-specific and virtual events taking place in April 2022, originating from electroacoustic studies at Concordia University and Geogiage. This is an occasion for revitalization and attenuation to our physical surroundings, uniting walkers and listeners from all disciplines. Soundwalk artists and academics will engage in public events that foster a deeper understanding of soundwalks as a means to embodied examinations of the socio-cultural spaces that we inhabit. These activities will explore post-colonial perspectives and power dynamics that shape the perspectives of listening to our environment. The series will feature soundwalks led by local sound artists. All events are open to the public at large, and panels will be held as hybrid events set in relevant physical settings with online components. 4 local soundwalks and accompanying discussion panels will occur on the first 4 Fridays of April, ending on International Earth Day, April 22nd. Visit www.soundwalksymposium.com for more information.
You are listening to.
Oh, merci beaucoup, Mme Saint-Onge. On va faire l'intro de Francis et les exerciceurs sur les ondes de CKUT, Radio McGill.
Je me suis endormi dans le bruit de mon sang. Je me suis endormi sur la terre en passant. Je me suis endormi comme on tranche une tête. Je me suis endormi comme aux ombres on se jette. Je me suis endormi.